Hello and welcome to Bayou de Beltway. I'm your host, Pearson Cross. Today we are joined by Dr. Tom Aiello, who has written a book called Jim Crow's Last Stand, Non-Unanimous Criminal Jury Verdicts in Louisiana with LSU Press. Dr. Aiello was born in Germany but quickly moved to Monroe, where he went to River Oaks High School, worked for the NLU, as it was at the time, Indians. Then he went up to Henderson College, got a bachelor's in history, came to UL Lafayette for his master's in history, went back to Arkansas, Fayetteville, for a PhD in history in 2007, then came back to UL Lafayette. I sense a boomerang effect here. Taught here for 3 years. Then he got a position at Valdosta State in Georgia, where he currently teaches African-American history. His book, as we said, is Jim Crow's Last Stand, Non-Unanimous Criminal Jury Verdicts in Louisiana. And we're going to talk about non-unanimous juries today, mostly. Welcome to the show.
Thank you very much for having me.
Louisiana is currently one of two states that allows non-unanimous juries in felony cases. This has recently come to everybody's attention and has culminated in a constitutional amendment, Amendment 2. It's going to be on the ballot November 6th to replace this practice or get rid of it. How did you get interested in this jury and non-unanimous juries?
Well, it's interesting. You know, as someone who has lived here most of his life, but never had any cause to be in front of a judge, never got in trouble legally, I had no idea this was a thing. And when I found out about it, I wasn't living in Louisiana, actually, and it was shocking to me that this could even be a thing, because I think everybody who's watched Law and Order, for example, has it kind of drilled into their head that all a defender needs is to get that one juror to have reasonable doubt, and that is the kind of the way to go, and that's just not the case in Louisiana. It was very eye-opening to me, not only that we do that, but that I didn't know, and that it is the kind of thing that is kept relatively quiet. And so I wanted to kind of shed some light on that and figure out why that was and trace the history of that. As an historian, that's kind of what we do. That's how we figure things out, is kind of to go backwards and kind of find out why things are the way they are.
Did that come as a part of your research? I mean, you currently teach African-American history. So as you got into African-American history and developed sort of an interest, did that arise naturally, that particular topic? I mean, how did it occur to you that, oh, this would be good to write a book about that?
It did. Several of my books are about black history, and several of them are about Louisiana history. And so this was a melding of those two interests. Certainly that played a role in that. But I think if I had found out that this was a thing at all about any state, it would have interested me enough to at least dig into why it existed.
Interesting. What's the relationship between the non-unanimous jury and Jim Crow? That may be sort of obscure for most people. Maybe you could just talk about Jim Crow a little bit to make sure our listeners know what Jim Crow is, and then talk about its relationship to non-unanimous juries.
Absolutely. After the Civil War, Louisiana went through a period of Reconstruction, wherein the former slave population that was now free was kind of being integrated into society as free people. The white population of Louisiana did not like this, did not want it to happen. And so after Reconstruction ends in 1877, white Louisianans and white Southerners across the region, for that matter, began a period of what we know as redemption, where these state governments tried to reimpose a version of white supremacy, to get back a version of the slavery that they had lost after their loss in the Civil War. To do that, they did a variety of things. They took away black political power by getting rid of the black right to vote, which had been there during Reconstruction. So they passed literacy tests and poll taxes and things like that. They also wanted to control black bodies in the way they did during slavery. And so they started passing segregation laws to be able to kind of control the movement of the black population. But the other thing they wanted to do, more than anything else, was to get free labor back. That was the big score of slavery. And the one loophole in the 13th Amendment that allowed them to do that was the statement that you're not allowed to put people in bondage because of race, but you are allowed to put them in bondage if they are convicted of a crime. And so Louisiana, along with all the other southern states, realized that they better start convicting former slaves of crimes. And that's exactly what they did. They started arresting the black population at will, passing bizarre laws against vagrancy and public drunkenness and improper behavior, all so that they could get people into the prison system. And then, because Louisiana was a small government, no bureaucracy kind of state, they made the case that, well, we don't really have a lot of prisons, and so what we'll do is we'll lease these prisoners out. And of course, they leased them out to the very slave owners who used to own that population. It's a concept known as convict lease, and it was kind of the core of the Jim Crow project, that final nail in the reimposition of slavery project. And it happens everywhere in the South. But in Louisiana, it happens incredibly uniquely, because unlike other southern states, Louisiana gives a monopolistic contract to one guy, a guy named S.L. James, who gets control of every convict in the state, and he is allowed to do with them what he will. And this gets a lot of, you know, pushback, because this doesn't seem right. This is essentially the early version of the privatized prison process that still gets criticized today, and he gets that kind of pushback. And so he decides that he needs to kind of centralize his operation in a place where a lot of people can't see. So he goes and he buys an old plantation called Angola, where he puts all of this prison convict labor that he's going to lease out. And he uses some of that labor to farm on Angola, and the rest of it he leases out for about $5 a head. And because this project is a little bit squirrely for a lot of people, and because a lot of people in Louisiana have been publicly drunk and, you know, are fearing that
shame. Well, that strikes me as a little ironic that right. In a state where Mardi Gras exists that you could get someone and put them in jail for public drunkenness.
it's a bizarre thing. Yeah. And so you might imagine that even though this is a project really designed to take free black residents and put them into this system, there are going to be a lot of people, white and otherwise, who kind of raise their eyebrows at this. And so to help make sure that the sweetheart deal that they gave to this guy is going to pay off, in 1880 they pass a law that says, well, we'll take care of those raised eyebrows by passing a law that says only 9 of 12 jurors need to convict people for crimes. That early law doesn't seem to be enforced all the time. It doesn't seem to have been relatively ubiquitous throughout the state, but it will be codified in 1898 in the state constitution. That is the constitution of Jim Crow. That is our white supremacist constitution. The leader of that convention to write our 1898 constitution even proclaimed from the floor that this was the meeting to defend white supremacy in Louisiana. It is the constitution that gave us all of those voting restrictions. It is the constitution that codified Jim Crow in every way. And it is the constitution that put 9-3 jury trials into the constitution of Louisiana. And of course, as we are a constitution writing state, all three of the constitutions that were written in the 20th century kind of passed that through and have kept it. And so it still remains the last Jim Crow law in the South.
We are talking today with Tom Aiello, who is an expert on non-unanimous jury verdicts. Well, a couple of questions. One, so the origin of Angola as the state prison kind of came out of S.L. James's boondoggle, where he's going to hide what he was doing from a lot of people and run his own real private operation. The second thing is, you've been saying 9-3, but we think of it as a 10-2 now. Did that change at some point?
It absolutely did. So I'll mention Angola first. Yes, Angola is going to be the convict leasing hub. But when convict lease falls in 1901, it falls across the South in the early 20th century to good government reforms because an average of 25% of convicts leased under this system die. I mean, it is horribly brutal, and it's just people are unable to ignore it. And
it's odd. The one thing that most people remember about this would be the Paul Newman movie, Cool Hand Luke, right? So very much the same thing, although with white protagonists, of course.
Exactly. And we know what's interesting about that is that's what happens. Though Louisiana gets rid of convict lease, they just replace it with leasing of just using prisoners for their own work, like in Cool Hand Luke. So what replaces convict lease is the chain gang. And so most of Louisiana's roads and bridges and everything else were built by convict labor, not because of convict lease, because that had gone away, but instead with just making Louisiana do the same thing. So the death rate stays incredibly high at Angola. And after that's over, they actually buy Angola from the James family and make it the state penitentiary. And even today, you know, more than 90% of the people who live at Angola are going to die there. Not a lot has changed in the last 150 years in Angola. As to the other question about 10 to 2, you're absolutely right. The Supreme Court will take up this issue in the early 1970s. And in a case known as Johnson v. Louisiana, tried in conjunction with a case from Oregon, a more famous case, Apodaca v. Oregon, who also has this kind of weird idiosyncrasy, the Supreme Court ruled that this was okay. It's actually very interesting. It was actually argued before the Supreme Court twice. The first time, if you look at the deliberations of the justices, 5-4 of them thought that this was unconstitutional, what we were doing. But in that intermediate period between the first argument and the second argument, one justice died, another retired, and Nixon was able to replace them with two justices who were very much in favor of non-unanimous juries. And so it switched from a 5-4 unconstitutional to a 5-4 constitutional, and it remained. Oregon's system was always 10-2. And the year after that 1972 decision in Johnson v. Louisiana, we got a new constitution.
That's right, the
1973 Constitution that we still use today. Right. And as a compromise during that Constitution, they switched to the Oregon standard of 10-2.
Wow. Well, it's interesting, and it shows what power the court has. We just, of course, have been thinking about the court with regard to Kavanaugh and all the issues about majorities or not majorities, and is the court balanced between liberals and conservatives? And so this is a really interesting case of you know, what presidential appointments can do. As I said, we're talking to Dr. Tom Aiello, who wrote a book called Jim Crow's Last Stand, Non-Unanimous Criminal Jury Verdicts in Louisiana, which is, of course, quite timely given the November 6th election, Amendment 2. We will talk some more when we return after this message.
The world feels like it's getting bigger all the time. There are daily developments on major stories around the world and more great music than at any other time. Staying current isn't always easy. But when you listen to KRVS, you hear about people, places, and ideas that matter to you, and you discover great music every day. Your support of KRVS makes that all possible. Please make your contribution today, online or mobile at krvs.org, and thank you.
I want to see you at high noon. Noontime, Thursdays on KRVS 88.7. For rock, roll, rhythm, it's old gold on KRVS. An hour on Thursdays at noontime. Isley Kleinpeter with an invite to join me Thursdays at noon on KRVS 88.7 for Fats Domino, Chuck Berry, Elvis, Carl Perkins, even Dolly Parton.
Hello and welcome back to Bayou de Beltway. I'm your host, Pearson Cross. We're talking today with Dr. Tom Aiello, who has written a book called Jim Crow's Last Stand, Non-Unanimous, easy for me to say, Criminal Jury Verdicts in Louisiana. Just as we were going to break, we were talking about Jim Crow and the Jim Crow origins, and we explained what Jim Crow was. a system to repress and reinstate in some ways vestiges of slavery legally after the Civil War. A question, most of the Jim Crow things that we come to associate, you know, with segregation, different water fountains, restaurants, public accommodations, voting, other kinds of things have gone away. So if this 10-2 criminal jury verdict is a vestige of Jim Crow, why didn't this one go away?
That's a good question. There are a couple of reasons for that. The first is that segregation is obviously designed to specifically keep non-white people out of white spaces. And voting restrictions are specifically designed to keep non-white people out of the ballot box. They are obvious. They are in your face. They are only designed to hit one group of people. And the kind of messages that you need to tear those things down fit on a poster and can be easily protested. Non-unanimous criminal jury verdicts are a little bit different in that even though this system is incredibly racialized, that it is very much designed to hurt the black population, and it still hurts the black population inordinately. White people get convicted on, you know, 9-3, 10-2 juries as well. There's an easy argument to make that if you don't want to be convicted of something, don't commit a crime. There is a general bias against convicted felons anyway. And so it doesn't make it into that general narrative. The other reason is that segregation laws, Jim Crow in general, spreads throughout the South. And so movement leaders like Martin Luther King and other of those large groups who are kind of going across the South making these cases, they're not making cases to Southern states. They're using Southern states to make cases to federal legislators to try to get them to overrule state decisions. And non-unanimous juries doesn't fit into that narrative because it only happens in one place. And the final reason, of course, is that most people just don't know about it. Unless you've had reason to go in front of a criminal judge in Louisiana, there's no reason you would ever know that this was even a thing.
Well, now people, when they find out about it, are a little shocked. But there are also people who are still supporting the idea of a 10-2.
Right.
And why would those people support that? I mean, if we kind of think, you know, 12 angry men, we're all thinking that's the standard of justice. But there are some arguments for people that people trot out. Would you know what those are?
Absolutely. Okay. So they have been gamely defended over the years. The main argument that people use is judicial efficiency, that Louisiana, while it does lead the world in
– we're pretty darn efficient. We put a lot of people in
right.
prison.
Right. We do lead the world in number of prisoners per 100,000. We best Iran and Russia and China very easily. We are the most incarcereal state on earth. We also have the fewest number of hung juries in the country. And the argument, the main argument in favor of non-unanimous juries is that it does decrease hung juries. It increases judicial efficiency. The state will save money because it doesn't have to continue retrying people. Now, that turns out not to technically be true. We don't actually save money because the number of criminal appeals based on 10-2 verdicts has been so astronomical that the state ends up having to pay for those appeals and the money ends up coming out in the wash. But as far as hung juries goes, it's very true. We do have very few hung juries. They also argue that theoretically speaking, you could be acquitted on a 10-2 jury as well. Now, that also turns out to be a relative rarity, that the vast majority of people who find themselves on the business end of a non-unanimous jury are getting convicted. But the main argument that they use and the argument that the Supreme Court used is that if we can find a judicially efficient way of doing business and it is consistently applied across the board, consistency is the only measure we need for fairness, for due process. And if as long as it's consistent, that should count. And they argue that 10-2 is far more than you need, for example, in Congress for a constitutional amendment. So why shouldn't that be good enough to convict?
Well, let's talk about that. Okay, so this 10-2 thing applies to white defendants and to black defendants alike.
Mm-hmm.
But people have argued that it affects, it disproportionately affects African Americans.
Oh, it does.
Explain that dynamic. How does that happen? Because in this seemingly neutral world that African Americans are convicted at higher rates using this kind of procedure.
Right. So there are two ways to describe that. The first is to talk about the juries themselves. The vast majority of the jury studies that we have demonstrate that juries are dominated by white men. And
Like everything else.
White men tend to make up the majority of most juries just because they tend to be the most called to jury duty. And so there are minority voices on the jury that end up forcing negotiations between jurors that create deliberation. When you have a 10-2 standard, then the people who get shouted down the most in those rooms, which is to say people of color and women, no longer have to be listened to. And so if that is the case, you have a jury system whereby it is predominantly white men making these decisions, and the voices of protest coming from black jurors, female jurors, jurors that have very different perspectives than the dominant white male perspective aren't going to have to be taken into account. That is going to be a genesis of affecting the black population a lot more.
So just to sketch that out.
Yeah.
And so what that means is, so we're sitting and we're deliberating about someone's guilt, right? And
right.
Or innocence. And if I know – if I'm the jury foreman and I know that if I can get 10 people to go along with me, we've got a conviction. But if there are one or two people and they have arguments that – or they don't seem to be totally on board if it's a unanimous standard, I have to bring that with me. I have to find a way to get them to go, yes, okay, I buy in. I'm buying in. But if you don't, then you kind of disregard that. So they may have very strong and good reasons, but you don't have to listen to them. Is that what you're saying?
Absolutely.
Okay.
And if you're being tried in Mississippi, that is the way it has to be. If you're being tried in Lafayette in a federal trial, that's the way it has to be. But in a state trial, that's not the way it is.
Wow.
The other thing that kind of we can demonstrate that this is weighted disproportionately racially.
Yes.
The New Orleans Advocate did a study very recently in which they took as many cases as parish governments would allow them to take, and they studied cases from 2011 to 2016, and they found that black defendants were prosecuted and convicted on non-unanimous juries about 43% of the time. 43% of the time there were jurors who thought they were innocent, but they still went to prison. For white defendants, it was about 30%. So there is a clear racial division in how we kind of prosecute these things. And it's not always intentional, to be sure, but the statistics bear out that in practice it happens, and it is very racially problematic, just as it was intended to be back in the Gilded Age.
One of the things that makes this so there's these statistical measures that you can point to, 43% versus 30 and so on.
Right.
But as I understand that, that is not that's not sufficient for courts. Courts don't accept statistical measures like that typically in these kind of decisions. So you can't oftentimes go to the Supreme Court, all the way to the Supreme Court, and say statistically it shows, because they've tried to do that in other decisions, but it doesn't work that way. It only works in a particular case. Can you show that there's racial prejudice in a particular case?
Absolutely. We can show particular cases and demonstrate that as well. And that has been tried several times. But and you're absolutely right. I mean, the academic standard, the historical standard is very different than the legal standard. And we're dealing with two very different worlds when we talk about these things. But every time that these appeals, kind of arguing that this was a racially weighted non-unanimous jury, every time they get into federal appellate courts, the Supreme Court, ever since 1972, has declined to hear these again because they said, well, we already did that. We don't want to mess with that again. And so the only way this was ever going to change is if we did get this constitutional amendment.
Well, let's talk about that a little bit. This went through the I think it was introduced by J.P. Morrell here.
Absolutely,
in
State Senate.
State Senate, State Senate Bill 243 that eventually turned into constitutional amendment number 2. It's going to be on the ballot November 6th. And the amendment basically requires Louisiana to adopt a unanimous standard for felony decisions in criminal cases, I believe. Was your book a part of this? I mean, this kind of came together, and do you feel in some sense like you've helped move this issue?
I hope so. I think so. When the book came out in late 2015, not a lot of people outside of the legal profession were really talking about this. And if the book played a role, then that is great. And I am very happy to have helped, because after doing this research, it seems very, very clear to me that this is, as somebody who does black history for a living, that this is very much a Jim Crow law, that it is very much having a racial effect, and that it really does need to go away. And as historians, we don't normally kind of make those kind of presentist conclusions. That's not something we do. And it's very rare that a history book could play into the present this way, and it's rewarding. Well, it'll be rewarding if it works, I guess. I should say, on November, if everybody goes out and votes.
Certainly. Of course, it's not called the J.P. Morrell didn't call it the Tom Aiello.
No, definitely not. I did not play that kind of role. There are plenty of great people on the ground in Louisiana who are actively kind of campaigning for this. I'm distanced. I'm in Georgia. I am certainly not doing the kind of legwork that I think a lot of great people in the state are doing, including Mr. Morrell and Ed Tarpley and others. While hopefully I was able to help, there are great people actually here on the ground doing the kind of work that needs to be done to make this happen.
Yeah. There are a number of organizations, Louisiana's for Prison Reform and Voice of the Experienced and some others. It seems like the time for this has come. I've noticed recently that a number of groups that I wouldn't expect necessarily to support this amendment to have come on board, like Americans for Prosperity, the Koch brothers,
absolutely,
Louisiana Family Forum, are supporting the passage of Amendment 2. What do you think explains this kind of embrace?
It's interesting. You know, they come at it from a different way than the kind of generic historical way. But they make the case, and I think rightly so, that this is a matter of liberty. That if the state can take away your liberty without a unanimous jury, then that is government overreach. And for a conservative population, the generic conservative argument is that we want the federal government out of our lives. We even want state government out of our lives. We want independence. And you can't claim to have any safety on liberty issues if you allow this to keep happening. And so this has become a nonpartisan issue. The conservatives and the liberals tend to both support it.
Although for perhaps different reasons.
Different reasons, but they get to it, and they both get to it from different ways, but they both get to it. And it's really great. It's really great that this is something that in a polarized time like this that people are able to come together on.
Very interesting. Well, as we said, the non-unanimous jury is going to show up on the ballot on November 6th. So go out and vote. We have been talking today with Dr. Tom Aiello, who wrote a book called Jim Crow's Last Stand, Non-Unanimous Criminal Jury Verdicts in Louisiana. Thanks for coming to the show.
Thank you for having me.
Bayou to Beltway is copyrighted by KRVS for the private use of its audience. Any other use of any portion of this program without written consent of KRVS is prohibited. The views expressed on this program are those of the participants and do not necessarily reflect the views of KRVS, its officers, or members. To listen to a podcast of the interview we just heard, go to krvs.org.
Well, hey there, this is Courtney Petrie with Bluegrass Highway. Join me every Saturday night at 8 p.m. Central Time for another edition of Bluegrass Highway on KRVS 88.7 FM, Lafayette, Lake Charles.
Well, I'm Lisa Mullins. PRI's The World brings you more than just the day's news.
In Cameroon, we have 260 languages.
We introduce you to people around the globe.
For a country like Iran, where you cannot really mingle with people outside your house.
This is giving hope to Turkish people.
There's one Chinese saying, everyone wants to be a rich guy, right?
Join us and hear the world.
Monday through Thursday afternoon at 2 here on KRVS.